Loneliness at NEWFM.
Sending out an SOS.
FM. That concludes our loneliness theme on this premiere edition of Mixed Bag. You'll never be lonely with us at 102.7. This is Pete Fornital on the new Sunday show, and I'll be back with my special guest, Don McLean, right after this interlude.
Hi, everybody. This is Stevie Nicks, and on behalf of myself and everybody in Fleetwood Mac, I want to thank you for listening to our music all these years and wish you a very happy holiday.
NEWFM invites you to have a room of your own.
The people who make the music and whose music has made a lasting impression over the years. One such person is my special guest on this premiere edition of Mixed Bag, Don McLean. Don, congratulations on your recent 10th anniversary concert at Carnegie Hall.
Thank you.
Now, what exactly was the planning for that 10th anniversary concert? How was it chosen?
It is a bit nebulous. You could say it was 10 years since Tapestry came out, which would be 1980. You could say it was 10 years since American Pie was released, which was 81. Or you could say it was 10 years since American Pie sort of and Vincent and that whole album became important to a lot of people. So what I did was I basically started a world tour around the beginning of 82, and at the end, when we got to Carnegie Hall, we summed the whole year up as a 10th anniversary world tour, with the last show being at Carnegie Hall. We were in about, I guess, 16 different countries.
Is Carnegie a special place to play for you, Don?
It is a special place.
You've been there before, of course.
Yeah, I've been there twice before, and I believe that if you are ready to perform, that it will bring out your best, and if you're not, that it will make you do pretty badly.
What kind of audience came to the 10th anniversary show?
Well, they're basically the audience that have stayed with me, I think, over all these years, whether or not I was the next Bob Dylan or the next James Taylor, or whether or not I was just Don McLean playing my songs from the days of the Village, when I first worked nightclubs and small concerts and churches and benefits. The audience has been always young and old. And even when I was getting airplay on this station 12, 13 years ago, and my first album, Tapestry, came out, there were always the fans of pop music and romantic music, as well as the folk fans, as well as the soft rock or the rock fans, but mm-hmm. not too many motorcycle jackets out there.
That reminds me of a wonderful moment that we shared together many years ago. I want to preface it by saying that some of your fans were surprised that this was a 10th anniversary concert, because, of course, their feelings for you go back longer than that, number one. Number two, I remember emceeing a show of yours at a small auditorium in Hackensack, New Jersey. Actually, a very nice facility, Ori DeNoyer, something like that. And during the set, you would play the opening notes to a song, and there were smatterings of applause coming from the audience. And you stopped dead in the middle of the performance to acknowledge that that was the first time that that had happened. And, of course, you connected it to the FM airplay that played such a big part back in the Tapestry
days.
Well,
I was quickly brought from being a young and up and coming artist to that guy that did American Pie, and it happened within, I would say, about a year and a half. Yeah. That whole transition happened, and I found myself basically grappling with that for about 7 or 8 years later, and now I don't really grapple with it. I think it's just something that's there. But the fallout from the enormity of the hit that American Pie was in the States, basically, with the exception, again, of those people who still follow my career and who have all these years and who came to Carnegie Hall, it ran the risk of just wiping out any kind of awareness on the part of the audience for the other things that I do. And it took a long time. It took a hit of Crying, it took a hit of And I Love You So, it took Vincent, which came, it took us many smaller hits like Dreidel and If We Try, and Wonderful Baby, which was number one on the easy listening charts for months, and since I don't have you and Castles in the Air recently, if it's kind of a full circle, I took all of that to basically convince the world that I had a few other songs in my bag besides American Pie. That's how big a hit it was. That it because the New York Times was giving me great reviews of Tapestry and of my early club and concert appearances. And after American Pie came out, many people in Rolling Stone and on radio and in especially in the New York Times felt it was their duty to somehow say, well, this is really great, but this other stuff he does is okay. And so that was the way they wrote about me for a long time.
Well, you went from being a very quiet success earlier on to suddenly this media phenom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've since, of course, seen a lot of other people go through their version of it. I mean, you know, Henry Winkler is forever stuck in that thing, no matter how much he wants to tell us he went to Yale and studied, you know, drama. And it's too bad. Yeah. And Freddie Prinze couldn't handle that blast. Many people, friends of mine, whether they were Jim Croce or Harry Chapin, other people that I knew, responded by moving, I think, too fast to meet all the opportunities that were now there that hadn't been there years before. So there are many traps you can fall into with this.
I would like to ask you more specifically about American Pie again a little later on, but for now, I have to tell you again, for the 130th time probably, what an impact that Tapestry had on my life. I remember that year of 1970 very vividly.
I remember it well, too.
Gave it as Christmas presents to tons of people because I thought it was a very special record. Is it still a special record for you?
Yeah, it's a special record for me, and I think that most of the folks out there who know anything about my music and the 8 or 10 albums I've put out over the last 10 years count it as the best or one of the best.
Would you mind performing a selection from it for us?
No, this one has been very good to me. As I say, And I Love You So came off of Tapestry, and I think that's one of the best things that ever happened to me because it kind of, well, it's used at weddings a lot. It's a it is the ultimate romantic song, I think, of the 70s, and I was always a lover of romantic music.
It bridged a few generations, too, in
still
its recordings
does.
By other
still
people.
Still does, and that's the reason there's so many people of all different stripes at my shows.
Yeah.
But this song is Castles in the Air, and I'm going to take a shot at it here.
Okay, engineering is not my strong suit, but we'll see if we can put this together. Don, would you like to introduce your accompanist?
Oh, certainly. This is John Platania, who will be playing the filigree on the guitar. And he's been with me for about a year now, and throughout the world tour and several tours of the United States, he's worked with Van Morrison and Judy Collins and Bonnie Raitt, and we love the way he plays, and I hope the audience will appreciate how nicely he does play.
Let's do it.
Castles in the Air. If she asks you why, you can tell her that I told you that I'm tired of castles in the air. I've got a dream. I want the world to share in castle walls. Just lead me to despair. And if she asks you why, you can tell her that I told you that I'm tired. Castles in the air, I've got a dream. I want the world to share in castle walls. Just lead me to despair.
John McClain live at NEWFM on the premiere edition of Mixed Bag. That song has gone through a lot of changes over the years.
I remember still recorded it like I do it.
That's right. That's right. Because on the original Media Arts album, it's a different mix than the one that appeared on the UA reissue. And then there was the version a couple of years ago, and now this stunning live performance in our studios at NEWFM. Tell the story, Don, of the Tapestry album and the difficulties you had just getting your music out to the public.
Well, this is something that I am asked to talk about from time to time, and anyone who wants to start in the music business, and I've seen it come and go. I've seen it when there were times where if you thought about being in the music business, well, the chances are that your other choice in life would be pimp or maybe Shylock or something. And then it became very fashionable and desirable on the part of middle-class parents to wish that their kids were in show business. This was around the time that you and I met in the early 70s when there were a lot of respectability, I think, was added with James Taylor and Carly Simon and a lot of people who were from the other side of the tracks, the good side of the tracks. And when I began, of course, I started in the early 60s. In fact, around 62, I guess, or 3, I began to make a few bucks singing and even had the nerve to think I could teach people a little guitar, which I also made a little money with. So I had my eyes on making an album for all through the 60s, when I was in night school, when I was in day school for a while, when I was out doing being a third act on a three-act bill, which was frequently my calling. And I started really auditioning for record labels in 1968, where I would go to Decca, I would go to Columbia, I would go to MCA, I would go to, I don't think there was MCA then, it was right. Decca. And I went all around, and then there were many tapes made, there were numerous auditions of the material that appear on Tapestry, and I was given okay, that's great, we really like it, and then a little while later, sorry, we don't want it. And that was just me. At this point, there wasn't an album called Tapestry. Right. Then I had a deal with Polydor Records and some money, too, and went out and started to cut a record, but still no final deal. And then they backed out, leaving everybody holding the bag.
Mm.
And once again, I now had about, I guess, 12,000 in debts. And an album that nobody wanted. And besides, I had auditioned for every one of these people before, and you know how they are when it comes to putting out a product. They'd prefer to put something out that they had something to do with, right, rather than buy a master, especially in those days. So it added up to about 30 or 32, I guess, record companies before I ended up on a little label called Media Arts out in L.A., And the reason I was on that label was twofold. One is that my manager and a guy that I had been making a film with, both of these people saw this company as about the last resort, and they both ended up with tapes on their desk of me doing the stuff that would eventually, that was Tapestry. So thank God they liked it. And in fact, there was a great guy, well, there were two great guys there. One was named Alan Livingston, and he signed the Beatles to Capitol. He was a big wig at Capitol. Signed all sorts of people there and made Sinatra, you know, you name it. He ran the company, and this was his new venture, and there was another guy named Bob York there who was responsible for the Class, a lot of the Class, and the real fine recordings that RCA made in the 50s and 60s, especially classical music that they did. Mm-hmm. And he was a very sensitive guy who really held my stuff in his hand as if it was gold. He didn't really see it as product. He didn't see me as cheesecake. And and he was really, it was one of the last times I ever had treatment like that from a record company. And
ooh,
it was the first label I ever had.
There's an indictment.
Well, it's not meant to be. It's just the truth. I suppose others have had better luck than I've had with that sort of thing. But 6 months after the company came out and had Tapestry out there, as well as Dory Previn's records and an album by Spencer Davis and another album by, believe it or not, Orson Welles.
Wow.
Who will eat no cow before it's time. He had a thing called the Begatting of the President out there, and it was all a whole biblical put-down of Nixon and his origins and what he was doing to the country. It was a fantastic record. I don't know if you pick it. You can pick it up every once in a while in the cutout bins. But it was a great, great reading, you know, thunderously read. And pretty much in 6 months, United Artists, which was in search of talent, had started to distribute Media Arts records. And pretty soon there was one of the first of several soft periods in the market, as we say, around 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And Media Arts was pretty much sold pretty quickly to United Artists. Now, my second album, which was American Pie, was all set to be handed over to Media Arts. It was finished. I had my producer. My record was cut. And UA walked in and looked like they had really done something when, in fact, Media Arts had done most of what they claimed to have done. And
sure.
When it came down to really understanding the music that I was making, they really didn't. So it led to a long period of releasing albums without a whole lot of understanding on the part of the record company as to what I was doing.
I'm going to defer the American Pie discussion yet again to ask instead about another song that appeared on that second album, which was equally phenomenal in its own way for you. Wouldn't you agree?
And I Love You So.
No, I was thinking of Vincent.
No, that's on American Pie.
That's what I meant. In other words, deferring discussion about American Pie
well,
in favor of
that
Vincent.
Song. For me, is a reason why I'm an international star and not just a guy who had a hit 10 years ago. It's a big difference.
Big difference. Big
I have you know, voluminous gold and platinum albums from all over the world because the audience accepted Don McLean, the artist and the songwriter, and not just the guy who did American Pie immediately. And so I had a big concert career. I just finished, for example, the most successful tour of Australia I have ever done. In fact, I hear where a lot of people like Dan Fogelberg and John Denver and people like that are going out solo now, much in the way I was criticized for doing.
I saw Fogelberg at Nassau a couple of weeks ago, and I was very, very suspicious of that type of performance in that type of outlet, and he did it.
Well,
and I think those people.
It's very important to do it. That's where it all starts. And anybody who is a successful performing artist should be able to do it. It isn't that difficult. It really does mean, though, that you have to have the material in order to rest on it because you don't have your arrangements.
So
if he has the material, that's what that means.
Environment, though, definitely plays a role. Obviously, there's a role to be played.
We differ about this.
Okay.
A lot of people have always... I differ about it only in that it's a cop-out to give some credence to the audience or the environment, in my book anyway, as to why things happen the way they do. Sometimes it takes a Leviathan effort in order to make certain things happen in a certain hall or with a certain type of an audience. But since I started out in show business, I have come across artists like myself or managers or agents or people in the business who almost first will talk about the environment of the room. And see, my whole approach to music is that an artist, whoever he is, takes his environment with him wherever he goes. And if you were to see Edith Piaf, you know, in Carnegie Hall or at the Bottom Line or at the Meadowlands out there, you would probably come away with the same feeling inside. You just have gotten closer to the sound, or it would have been a different sound.
Well,
I think that a lot of people are going back to that basic attitude about performing, and it is proof of that fact is in that they are willing to leave the arrangements and all the orchestrations behind, the dancing girls and the smoke bombs, in order to go out and do what it is they're doing.
But doesn't that assume the cooperation of a lot of the variables like the technology and the sound system, et cetera, et cetera? No?
That's another thing that I tend to think. I think that all the technology that we have today has resulted... Have you noticed any special crystallization of the human voice coming through vinyl lately? Have you heard any voices that you think are going to stop time? I haven't.
Well, no, but the total package is different.
In fact, I have heard what sounds to me more like the same voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is what technology has done, is it's managed to homogenize out so much of the special intangible qualities that make art and make music and make a great live performer basically the same performer, whether or not he or she is at Carnegie Hall or at a 20,000-seat place or at a nightclub.
I'm going to concede one to your camp because I'm just thinking about those gramophone recordings of Caruso that still exist.
Yeah.
They work.
They not only work, but if you tune your ear to them, you can hear the 1910.
Yeah.
And you can hear the energy, and you can hear the determination. You can hear... you can hear a mindset in some of those old records, which is one of the wonderful things that allows us to go back, and one of the few things that allows us to go back and to experience different decades firsthand in the hands of those who lived then, mm-hmm. not a la, you know, Happy Days on TV or Grease in the movies with people in there who weren't born when custom-made hotshot Cadillacs were going down the road. I mean, they don't know what it is they're talking about. And that is another, I think, unfortunate byproduct of technology.
Don, I want to jump back to the song that kicked off this discussion, which is Vincent. What chord do you think that struck in people to make it the success that it was and is?
Well, I think that that occasionally people aren't in favor of modernity. And a lot of my music, I think partly the role that I play is as a, I'm not really a protest singer against modernity, because I don't believe in being a protest singer all the time. I do believe there is always room for an angry song amongst all other kinds of songs.
Finger-pointing songs, as they were once called.
Yeah, less than that even. I would say that in my case, Prime Time is the closest thing to a protest song I've ever written. Tapestry is a protest song, but who does it point the finger at? It points the finger at the complexity of everything, and that if you put something in one end, it's going to come out the other, and touch us all along the way. So that's the kind of point of view I've tried to have. Vincent is a protest song. It's a song which protests the need for love and beauty in a world that even in the time of Van Gogh's life was progressively moving away from those values.
Would you perform it for us?
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land. I think I know what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they're not listening still. Perhaps they never will.
Timeless and wonderful as ever, that is Don McLean live on the premiere edition of Mixed Bag at NEWFM in New York. premiere edition of Mixed Bag at NEWFM in New York with my special guest, Don McLean. Don, thank you so much for, A, consenting to be our...
Thanks for having me.
Debut artist, as it were. Debut artist?
Debut.
Give me a break.
Yeah.
And also for performing for us as well. Has anyone dared to cover Vincent?
Jane Oliver, I think. Diane Carroll. People who like the big sweep of an arrangement have tried it. In fact, Diane Carroll told me once that she had to, it cost her $3,000 to just set up the song.
Wow.
In Las Vegas. She had all these paintings and everything, and it all had to be, it was just a big deal. I mean, just to do the song, it cost $3,000.
This is a television special. This is a...
Well, life's a television special. Isn't it?
Ain't that the truth, boy? And in your case, a lot of interesting detours and musical connections are involved with your career. And the one that comes to mind right now is that you were the subject of a hit recording for someone else. Do you mind telling us about that?
Well, as we were saying... before, Lori Lieberman was the person for whom Killing Me Softly was written, and she's gotten quite a short shrift, really, in the scramble to lay claim to who is the song is written about and who is going to get the Grammy and who has the hit. It was actually written for her about her recollections of a show that I did. So that's the story, and she made the first recording of it. And it was used as a demo by, as so many of our recordings are, was used by as a demo by Roberta Flack, who cut basically her version, except for the little guitar thing that Hugh McCracken does in the first part of Roberta's song, produced by Joel Dorn, who is another very good reason why the record was so successful.
But what a tribute to you. I mean, how did you find out about this? And do you remember your reaction at the time?
Well, I was just hanging around the house like I usually do when I'm not on the road, doing a whole lot of little silly things that most people wouldn't associate with guitar strumming songwriter. You know, just odd jobs of one sort or another that pop up. And I got a phone call while I was busy. And this friend of mine out in L.A. said, we saw Lori Lieberman at the Ice House, which is a little joint out in Pasadena, I think. And she told the story of how the song Killing Me Softly was written, and at that time it was a big hit. So I hadn't heard it, and I just said, is it any good? Because basically all I remember was, we love you, Beatles. Oh, yes, we do. I could just see you. We love you, Don. You know, on the radio, and I'd have another reason to head for the hills. So it turned out that I was a little nervous and put the thing on and listened to it, and I thought, gee, this is a great song. It's nice. And I later on got to meet Lori and Roberta. And...